Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 25th of January, 2017. And of course, this show deals with evergreen issues. It doesn't do current events. Current events are too ephemeral. But when current events are that manifest something far more universal, then we have to deal with them. We've done that from time to time, and I've justified that. But what we're witnessing in America is extraordinary. Everything that nationalists, monarchists, and populists have been saying for the last 40 years or more is finally coming to fruition. Everything that we have been predicting has come true almost in every detail. Now, we've always known this about the system, but to see it in front of our face every day, to see millions believe it, to see how right we were about what these people really are and about the nature of revolutionary politics, it's disconcerting. It's sort of like when you have a relative who's dying and it takes a long time, they're withering away to die. You think you prepare yourself, you know, because it's such a long time watching them go down and down and down. But when it actually happens, no matter how long you've had to prepare yourself, it's never quite, you're still shocked and you're still saddened, because only then does it become real. It goes from something hypothetical to something that's real and irreversible. And that's where we are right now. Donald Trump is not the issue. Donald Trump is a shrewd man, is a devious man. Like anybody who makes their money in that world, that's the, you know, deviousness and being shrewd and unscrupulous. I mean, that's the central traits you have to have. Rarely in his career did he deal with ideology or political theory outside of the regulatory, you know, world of Atlantic City or New Jersey or Manhattan. But he came to the presidency really with a few key points. The primary one was to rid the country of illegal immigrants, highly limit legal immigration, enforce immigration laws, and deport the millions who are here illegally and who are doing a tremendous damage to the infrastructure of the southwestern United States. But more than that, he's talking about import substitution in certain cases. He's talking about pulling the U.S. out of the U.N. What I think happened is that he had a few very limited goals early on, realizing that put him in the, you know, what could, in the Pat Buchanan camp. He had to then add other things to make him more consistent with that camp. He didn't have a unified political theory when he first started, but he does now. And I think he does out of necessity, knowing full well that what he's promoting is a part of a much larger agenda that's consistent, and it's consistent only when it's placed in contact with other things. He was never a religious man. But of course, as president, he's dealing with a movement that's Christian, overwhelmingly Christian, and he has to put that into practice. He's doing nothing but imposing an agenda that he was elected to do, and that was, up until just a generation ago, considered absolutely normal and not up for debate. The main issue, of course, is that the regime, I'm talking about the unification and really the complete synthesis of public and private capital, media, academia, and most of the churches, are engaged in an attempted coup against Donald Trump. Now, again, it's not about him personally. He's not an articulate nationalist. It's never been his area. But it's against nationalism as such. And in the American context, it is Christian nationalism and everything that means in American Western Europe. It's a war against me. It's a war against probably you. And the rhetoric is clear. You know, they want us in camps. it's not theoretical. If you just listen to the audio of these elite finance protests, you'll hear it. But it's systematic in the sense that these groups that have attempted to shut down Trump's inauguration a few days ago and overthrow him in a coup, as you saw in Ukraine, essentially a color revolution, none of these things are or could ever be spontaneous. It didn't take me long, since I do this, 24 hours a day, I found out all the main financiers. George Soros is not prominent among them this time around. Mostly, it's the Disrupt organization is mostly from Boston, and it's very 20-something millionaires connected both with Harvard and MIT. So these people are they're more radical even than the Goldman Sachs. Daniel Shin is from Goldman Sachs, used to be from Goldman Sachs, is the main financier here. The point is, this has been planned for some time. When you have a protest like this, you have to have a very detailed plan. You have to have an infrastructure in place for transportation, lodging, bail money, tactics, everything you could possibly use to bring these different groups together and bring them to where they're supposed to be. And these guys are used to taking risks, and they're used to investing money for at least medium-term goals. And then on top of it all, you have government agencies like the CIA, who are very much a part of the attack on Trump. And when this first began, I was reminded of Richard Nixon. I was reminded of 1972. I was less than a year old. But in 1972, Richard Nixon, for the second time, humiliated the American left. Now there, it was a complete slaughter, George McGovern's people. But George McGovern represented the liberals at the time in the most blatant and overt way. So the ideological line, not that Nixon was this articulate nationalist, he was nothing of the kind. He was far more intelligent than the crop of politicians that you have now. And he was an actual scholar of international relations, unlike the crop you have now. And I'm probably the last one who did. But he humiliated the left twice. It proved without question that the United States population hated liberalism, hated everything it meant, and the people in the streets who, again, although we didn't have the web back then, were very well paid and lodged by the regime. There's a longstanding theory that the CIA was very worried about Nixon because he was very independent. He probably had more knowledge than they did about international affairs. And after the Alger Hiss case, became a threat. There was never any such thing as a Cold War. American capitalism was so heavily invested in the USSR, you would have to redefine the term war for that to be true. Now, after 1972, the Washington Post and the CIA, the Post has always been a CIA conduit. The former owner used to say that, and it was dead, killed in his bathtub right after that. Created something called Watergate. The Watergate thing, makes no sense whatsoever. Everyone knew that Nixon was going to mop up whatever Democrat they could throw against him. And so why he would have any interest in caring what the Democratic National Committee was doing is kind of ridiculous. And it's the same thing you have now, the idea of Russian hacking, as if this were really to happen, that they would leave traces. They're good enough to thwart the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI and the NSA, but not good enough to cover up their tracks. But these people lie for a living, and it's idiotic from the beginning. Just like the idea that Nixon would ever care what the DNC was doing, knowing full well that he was going to win almost 50 states, and that no Democrat had a chance against him. So the whole thing was laughable. But we were more limited then, in the sense that you had limited sources of information. So the press whipped up some of the population in a frenzy that somehow this happened, he had a reason to do this, and it was a terrible crime against humanity. No one could quite put their finger on it, because he didn't actually do anything. Members of his staff allegedly did, and then Nixon always wiretapped all of his offices in the White House, which is an odd thing to do if he's going to commit a crime. Had deleted just a few minutes of audio tape. And Nixon didn't handle it well. None of us would have. It's kind of a new thing with the televised debates and discussions and the total control of the press by one group of people. The press was uniformly liberal at the time. Conservatism of any kind hadn't really developed yet, especially after 1964, they were completely demoralized. But the point is that regardless of the very weak case they had, regardless of the fact that it did make sense, that Nixon had never done or even considered anything like this before, the Washington Post went on a CIA finance crusade to destroy Richard Nixon, and they succeeded. You ask even a scholar today what Watergate is, and you will get some very vague discussion about him covering up something that he may or may not have done. This was sufficient to bring the country into utter turmoil and to destroy it. After that, the presidency was not taken seriously anymore. Watergate destroyed whatever connection the people in the presidency ever deserved together was destroyed. And that's after that you had the mockery of whether people deserved it or not. The presidential office and the U.S. government, for better or for worse, was no longer taken seriously. And this was strictly a leftist thing. It was a way to assist the Soviet Union and the overthrow of any form of Christianity, nationalism, or the family in the West. So that wasn't about Nixon, just like this isn't about Donald Trump. Now, we have more sources of information now. The punchline here, the punchline to all of this, is that it's very easy to discover who's financing this. So what you have is a coalition of the press, almost without exception, academia without exception, the major Washington think tanks with the occasional exception. They're financed by the old money foundations, the most powerful and wealthy families in American history, finance capital without exception, both the Republican Party, most the Democratic Party, the overwhelming majority of corporate America. They have arrayed themselves against Donald Trump, his voters and supporters, a few biker groups, and fringe writers and scholars like myself. That's the array of forces here. I believe that it's very possible that I criticized Donald Trump for bringing this General Mattis on board. I discussed this elsewhere. He's a neocon. He's a shill for Goldman Sachs. But it's becoming clear now that he's there to be a bodyguard for Trump against the CIA. At the time, I wondered why he would bring someone who was working for Soros at the Center for New American Defense, both Soros and Goldman Sachs, or finance that organization. He's on the board of directors. I'm wondering, but now I get it. Having someone like him and bringing in others like him is essential if he's going to take on the CIA directly. CIA is not merely this intelligence agency. It's got a network of very powerful institutions, both private and public. A big difference also between Nixon and Trump is that Nixon inherited a more or less healthy society, healthy in every way, religiously and racially, and ethnically, the balance of the demographics, the stress on the family, all of this. It was coming apart, but it was still generally healthy. Right now, you have a fractured, broke, demoralized, and completely amoral, nihilistic population as a whole. Radically misinformed, regardless of the fact that they are inundated with information 24 hours a day. So you have a decaying system that will soon come crashing down. It has no buttresses, no matter what happens here. That's a big difference. So the punchline here is that you have the elites of the world, the regime, as I've always called it, deciding that it's either now or never. And if Trump loses, if Trump is overthrown or killed, there will be open season on our people. Had he lost the election, the same would be true. There'll be no mercy. And I think, as Matt Heinbeck said when that kid was kidnapped and tortured in Chicago, you think you could sit this out? You think that you can, be neutral and please your boss and everything else, but you know you can't. You know that you can't do this anymore. If you have any conscience at all, you realize that you have to come forward no matter what the consequences. And I've done it. many of them we've been punished severely for. We are a growing number. We're willing to help each other. And but, you know, if you're not willing to do it, then stand aside and prepare to deal with the consequences, regardless of what happens. Because no matter what happens, whether which side wins, if you could even call us a side, those who remain neutral will still be irrelevant and will be dealt with. Remember, the mob, masses, they don't make history. They don't win wars. They don't do anything of value. So that's the situation right now. It's not about politics. It's about the New World Order. It's about Antichrist's presence in the world as he's manifested now entirely. You know, the inverted pentagram deals with the inversion of all things, the rule of passion over reason, the rule of matter over spirit, the rule of money over common good. The perversion of all things. It is to the natural order what Solomon was to Israel. Solomon is the nodal point for all occult forces, for Satanism, for ecumenism, for globalism. Everything is about building Solomon's temple. The number 666 comes from the amount of gold that was reported in the Old Testament that he possessed at the time. And the symbolism of gold and the sun and Apollo is well known. So the point of it all, this is not going to be our topic here, but I think it necessary that I express this in some detail. That's what's happening here. There's no excuse to watch CNN or any of the major news sources, because now they've already said many times they're not going to cover this objectively. We are revolutionaries, and this is how we're going to do things. And so watching them, there's no excuse there. There's other ways to get your information. And even there, even the best sources are really struggling right now to figure out what's important, what isn't, what's a diversion, what is not. My biggest fear, and I'll end here, my biggest single fear is that we don't have the nationalists in America, we don't have the maturity, the numbers, the intellectuals, the statesmen to take advantage of this. When I see right-wingers or nationalists infighting, I'm going to react very harshly. Shut your mouth. You're not perfect. You've made mistakes. You've been wrong. You've done the wrong thing. You're not in a position of leadership. You don't know what it is. We can't do this right now. Everybody has something valuable to bring to the table. Talking about other people might make you feel good, but it doesn't do any good, and you don't do any good. This is not a hobby. This is not a game you play. This is not, you know, something you do in your spare time. You're going to go to prison, very possibly, for talking about this stuff the way we do. There's no law here. All their own rules are, have been thrown out the window. There's no, you know, when it comes to us, there is going to be no habeas corpus. That couldn't be clearer. And it doesn't matter what the regime does, because their press will cover for them. But given these elections, everything from Brexit to the Philippines to Russia to the Trump election, the regime says it's either now or we are finished. There will be no infighting. Keep your criticisms to yourself. None of us are perfect. We don't agree with everything that we say. You know, people make mistakes. We misinterpret. And it's going to get worse now because we're struggling for a good source of information. It's a tremendous amount of work just to figure out what's real and what isn't. This isn't about you making yourself feel better about yourself. This isn't about you feeling like you matter. And one last thing. The federal government isn't interested in what you say. Everyone knows that all you got to do is open up a discussion forum online and the right wing will destroy itself. Why in the hell are they going to invest money in trying to infiltrate a movement that doesn't exist? Nationalism is a series of what they call the alt-right, which is not exactly a group of political theorists who can define anything properly. I don't even know what it is. I don't care. It's a neologism. But the purpose is that the regime can't penetrate what doesn't exist. There is no movement. There's hardly any organizations. There's no money. There's simply a group of very eccentric personalities. And that's about it. It's not a movement. You have to have a movement. You have to have an infrastructure. You have to have politicians in office, you have to have think tanks, you have to have international support, you have to have a full infrastructure in place. There's nothing, we have nothing like that in this country. The neocons, the neolibs, and the Marxists to rule everything without exception, including the churches. So we are a handful of often articulate, very well-educated, intelligent people, some of us, a lot of charlatans, a lot of frauds. But, you know, we're on the fringes here, at least for the moment. That may be changing very rapidly. You're not going to get the highest, you know, you're not going to get establishment people here. Now, whether or not that means that we're going to get idiosyncratic people, or whether it means that people are going to use that to infiltrate it for their own purposes, that's a separate issue. There is some money here. There is some. There is enough presence for unbalanced people to pretend that they're you know, playing like Gogol's Diary of a Madman, pretending he's the king of Spain. And what that comes from, this frustration, this frustrated wish fulfillment that has political overtones, sexual overtones, and career-oriented overtones. All of that was involved with his believing that he was the king of Spain in that short story. So I'm going to stop that now, but it's important that I say that. And in the future, you know, this isn't going to be that important, you know, 10 years from now. But this needs to be understood in light of everything that this show is about. Now, there is something vaguely similar in Imperial Russia, which is what this show is about to a great extent. And it's exactly 100 years ago. We're talking about the abdication of Tsar Nicholas. One of the things that played into this, and that no one has dealt with in English to any great extent, at least not systematically, is the role of Rasputin in the royal family and what that had to do with his abdication. The important thing to remember is that the Russian press at the time was very much like our own in the West. I've read dozens of articles from the press in that era, and it's shocking. Journalism was not really a good word at the time. It just meant muckraking. And it was a yellow journalism, even at the most elite levels. It was a part of the revolutionary movement. The purpose was to do to the royal family what the Washington Post did to Nixon. Make it an object of mockery. Make it an object of sexual scandal. Whether it's true or not is not important. The agenda is far more important. And with these people, you know, they have the two pillars of Joachim and Boaz, and they form a movement. One is severe, one is merciful, one is devious, the other one pretends to be cuddly. They both have a role to play here. So falsehood has as much a role as truth in these things. And as it turns out, those two pillars aren't really much of anything because there is there's no truth, there is no purpose. Revolutionaries don't know that. Low-level Masons don't know that. Rasputin remains a shadowy figure in American thinking. American academics have, as like to do with everything, have made the waters far murkier. They believe what they please. They don't understand Russian history or politics or the Russian mentality, and they're certainly not Orthodox. So what they write is worthless. When I wrote The Third Rome, there's a lot about that book that I have taken back. I was very, very young. But the very last chapter, I learned and I dealt with some depth that under Alexander Kerensky, the provisional government convened this emergency investigation committee for misuses of former ministers and other chief executive. That's my very bad translation of it. It's too rigid or too literal. What it is, this is the emergency committee that's going to deal with the corruption and evil of the previous regime. You figure they're just simply going to go in there and search all the records and find whatever they can to discredit the government. The problem was that they found nothing. I mean, even, you know, minor glitches were explainable. Given the purges of the bureaucracy under Nicholas I and Alexander III, you know, the bureaucracy wasn't as large. It was actually small compared to Western Europe. It was noble-based, and it was highly specialized. They, You know, there wasn't a lot of room for corruption. They were members of the nobility anyway. They were separate from the rest of the population way up in Petersburg. So corruption, in the sense that we use the term today, is very rare. You find very little of it. They were trying to uncover these crimes, but with all their incentives to find evil, they didn't. They found very little. One of the things that they dealt with was Rasputin. And I was shocked to learn that he was cleared completely of all charges, any kind of corruption, drunkenness, serial fornication, any of these things that he's been associated with in the popular mind. There was no evidence at all that he was ever a part of the Kalisti sect or any other occult group like this. Over foreign policy, very little influence over anything in the court, and that when you dig deeper, you realize that the press, the enemies of Russia abroad especially, were using all of this to try to delegitimize, not Nicholas personally, but the Orthodox world and Russia as its primary protection. July 1917, the report made by V.M. Rudnev, who was one of the main editors of this and compilers of this emergency committee's proceedings, makes a very clear statement. He says, all these pamphlets and newspaper articles, now I'm quoting him now, on the subject of Rasputin's influence and all these other rumors and gossip were fabricated by powerful enemies of the emperor. This statement is given under the signature and seal of the Attorney General of the High Commission, end quote. So this is done under oath. The provisional government had full access to everything that the old government had. There has never been an exhaustive inquiry like this against a conquered power anywhere. I mean, even in Germany after World War II, most of it was torched. There was no problems with Rasputin, morally speaking, and they made it very clear that the imperial government maintained the highest standards and personal dignity while holding office. And this is from sworn enemies of the imperial government. Now, up until fairly recently, material on Rasputin, especially in English, that had any real revisionist purpose was almost non-existent. I did a review of this book ages ago for the Barnes Review. Elizabeth Judas was the wife of Alexander Ivanovich, an officer in the Tsar's service, the police services. And she wrote Neither Devil Nor Saint, which is published and now sold by the Barnes Review out of Washington, D.C. This book makes it very clear the rumors about him and any kind of occult powers that he had were absolutely out of the question. One of the big problems that Nicholas had is one that his father had, and that is to deal with the nobility, especially family members close to the throne. This is where you start having problems. Now, it's true they had no official office but in the government, but it's true that they were often very spoiled and they had no sense of the common good. This you can't really blame him. Alexander III had done very well in this respect. And one of the reasons that terrorism in the Russian Empire subsided greatly was because Alexander III was able to curb the arrogance of the nobility. In fact, there's a perfect correlation between the lack of terrorism on the one hand and the ability of Alexander to control the great noble houses, especially those close to the Romanov memory. But not only did Alexander was not dealing with direct warfare all the time and was not dealing with the press as it turned out to be. Nicholas was an idealist. He believed, and I said this in other shows here before, he didn't like the idea of having an administration or a bureaucracy or even an imperial court that relied on threats and violence all the time. Tradition was an authority, but it was never a coercive power. He wanted to stress the idea that authority is sufficient. One of the central figures, one of Rasputin's central concepts here was that Nicholas saw the peasant classes, of having a knowledge, whether it be of horticulture or of medicine, or even of the church, that had been lost. That noble families moving to St. Petersburg, or families that became noble in government service, were completely cut off from this and had forgotten this. It's very important to realize that you know, we've been arguing this for a long time. There really is no progress. There's simply the domination of technique over you know, the ancient collection of knowledge coming from even beyond the existence of writing and being older than them. And you see this in all ancient civilizations. The peasantry maintain this far better than anybody else. But given the nature of modern society, especially in Russia, at the time you had an extreme, not only you had a geographical separation, but you had a personal, familial, ideological separation between the elites way up in Peter's floating city and then the peasantry who had nothing in common with them. Dr. Judas notes that Rasputin generally wanted to leave. He condemned any kind of hypnosis, these kind of methods used to calm Alexei. That's really all he did. Was simply calm the kid. He was trusted. He was easy to deal with, easy to talk to. There's no proof he was even aware of these kind of techniques. He didn't cure, nor did he ever claim to cure Alexei of anything. He simply soothed his nerves. He took no credit for anything that happened. He didn't want any reward for his services, never sought anything. And once he was no longer needed, he left, whether he was given leave or not. He usually left the company of the royal family and wanted to go home. He wanted to go back to Siberia, which is where he belonged, but was talked into staying. Now, since all the establishment papers call him power mad, this is odd behavior. There is no, according to Judas and all the eyewitnesses that they interviewed at the time, he had no political agenda that anyone can figure out. He was a monarchist really just by default. But this was more of a in the air and just, you know, part and partial of being a peasant in Russia at the time. So there's no real political agenda there whatsoever. Now, a certain Prince Felix Yusupov approached Rasputin, asking him to intercede with the royal family for the oldest Romanov's daughter's hand. In the royal family itself. Rasputin, he had been offered a bribe for this. You know, he wanted to marry Nicholas's oldest daughter and refused. He was offered a substantial amount of money, and Rasputin said no. Then Yusupov moved to England because he was embarrassed. The story that he was desperate for this girl, he wanted into the royal family very closely and had tried to bribe Rasputin. It began to circulate in Russia, and so he left in humiliation. It was Yusupov in Great Britain that where he began to circulate stories about Rasputin in the English press. He accused him of being a Jew, that he had the out-of-control libido that he's infamous for, and that he was an alcoholic. Now, given the fact that the British press, when it came to Russia, did nothing but spread rumors, that loathed the Russian Empire and the Russian people. They were very happy to hope that this is a nobleman close to the royal family. Look at what he's telling us about Rasputin in the royal court. And he was considered an authority. And this is where the rumors against Rasputin, and we're talking about 1909, 1910 here. And of course, the British press put it on the front page. The Russian press put it on the front page. Now, the emergency committee says Mikhail M. Libikov, he certifies and he's is testimonial to the committee that not a single indication of Rasputin's political activity was ever disclosed by the emergency committee. The inquiry was intensive, but it definitively established that his influence was only in the profound religious sentiments of their majesties. The only favor Rasputin accepted was the rental of his house, paid by the personal chancellor. He accepted presents occasionally made by the hands of the imperial family, like shirts or waistbands. He had no connection with any foreign power. And this is pay close attention here. He says, not all pamphlets and newspaper articles on the subject of Rasputin's influence and other rumors and gossip were fabricated by powerful enemies of the emperor. And again, This statement is given under the signature seal of the Attorney General, the High Commission. And that's on page 189 from the Judas Book, but you could also find it in the text of the Emergency Commission itself. Now, that press just by itself says that the entire history of early 20th century Russia has to be rewritten, that the provisional government had no right to exist, that the corruption in the government of the Russian Empire didn't exist, that Rasputin had no authority, no power in the court at all, was never there, or hardly ever there. He was there for one purpose and then wanted to leave. He occasionally was there for the sake of Alexei, but then he was at home in Siberia. He was not at home in Petersburg, did not get along with anybody, was seen with jealousy and suspicion, and so he at the first opportunity, wanted to leave the area. It should be noted that the chair of the Duma himself, M.V. Rodzianko, he admitted openly in his own work, the translation existed from 1990, he says that it was the Masonic Congress in Brussels that instructed him and led him to begin attacking Rasputin. Now, there's a new, in 1990, his memoirs came out, and more than once, he affirms the role of the lodges. Rodzianko himself was a Freemason. He was actually an open member. And there was the famous Baptist minister, J.S. Rokhanov, said that when Rasputin is gone, the reformation of Russia can begin. The British wanted to see the Tsar overthrown, and as I've said many times in this show, and you know, Russia was quickly becoming the most important threat to British dominance. And on a documentary from the BBC airing in 2007, it's called The Killing Rasputin, they seem to suggest that it was the very early version of the MI6 that killed him. There's a retired Scotland Yard inspector, Richard Cullen, and working with the historian Andrew Cook, conducted a study on this question, and they found that Rasputin was most likely killed by a Secret Service agent from Great Britain. It was called at the time the Secret Intelligence Service. A guy named Oswald Rayner, who was working at the Imperial Court at the time. And then the provisional government, which was very Masonic, not only immediately after his accession to power destroyed his tomb and the remains of Rasputin, but also then created the special commission to witness the sabotage to sabotage the activities of Rasputin's Russia. And this is exactly what never quite ended up exonerating the country rather than condemning it. So a lot of these stories about him simply are false. And this is a set of reasons as to why it came into existence in the first place. Over and over again, this extraordinary commission, is the name of it, exonerates him from all of the attacks that the yellow journalism at the time made to him. There is no evidence that he had any money at all. Rudnyev himself says that after his death, there was not a penny in savings. There was no estate whatsoever. It's common to believe that he was an alcoholic, and yet direct witnesses to him drinking anything is non-existent. There was one person who saw him drink some sweet wine during travel. And then during World War I, Rasputin was heard to have supported Nicholas' decision to ban alcohol throughout the empire. And the police tale that was put on him in Siberia in 1910 never saw him drinking at all, let alone drunk. One of the funny things is that they were trying to pin all these, you know, this fornication on him. And not because they actually didn't like that sort of thing. It was because it was a way to embarrass the royal family. They would have these, you know, horrible cartoons of Rasputin with, you know, having sex with Alexandra. And wherever they had Nicholas, they had Rasputin. Put in the popular mind, they're really one and the same. They actually did a medical examination of Anna Rubova and found she was a virgin. This is supposed to be his mistress. And, you know, over time, it became clear that these are all myths. And the witnesses that Rudnyev, again from the committee, he couldn't find anybody who was willing to give any instance of where he had some control over the life of the court. Bishop Alexis of Tobolsk, formerly the Exarch of Georgia, also did an in-depth study of the life of Gregory using the texts from the provisional inquiry as well as other places. He even went to Tumen to interview others who knew Rasputin. And he came back with not a shred of evidence that Rasputin was a sectarian, whether he was an alcoholic, that he cared about sex with women. In fact, he was firmly grounded in the Orthodox faith. In fact, the area in Siberia that he was analyzing had very little sectarian activity. And the property owned by Rasputin's family was never known to be anything other than Orthodox. And this bishop, as a form of expiation for the slander, donated 500 rubles for the construction of a temple in that church, and as a way to apologize to Siberia and for his memory. The main question is this. Everything in this era comes back to British hatred of all things Russian. Hatred comes from this kind of a threat, this kind of a worry that they're being directly challenged by a very, very powerful country. Once the expansion of the Baku oil fields continue to grow, Russia is sitting on a sea of oil. The British were looking for the thin end of the wedge, and Rasputin became that person. A guy like him is very easy to parody. He's very easy to attack. He looks menacing, you know. And as always, they're accusing Rasputin of everything that they, in fact, were. They're the ones who sought power, not him. Attacks on Rasputin were meant to delegitimize the monarchy and to bring the oligarchy to power. He wasn't even particularly close to the royal family, you know, only where Alexei was concerned. The point of all this, though, is that it's really the same cast of people, a different generation. It's the same elites from the same place. London, New York, overwhelmingly Jewish, planting stories and using the psychological association between one group and another to plant the idea that these people are evil. You know, I've been through Donald Trump's speeches, through his website, there is nothing racial about it. He hardly ever mentions it. But because he wanted it to limit the flow of cheap labor from the third world into this country, over time, the system planted the association in the heads of people that somehow he's now a racialist. And he's nothing of the kind. He's never said anything like that. It's a study in psychological manipulation and in brainwashing in the true sense. It's common that brainwashing works in times of great stress. When a war is over, people are exhausted, they want peace. Remember something. Americans are broke. Half of America owns nothing. If you have a lot of debt that's worth more than your assets, then you don't own anything. You're a complete proletarian. More than half of Americans, for this reason, own nothing. At the end of the empire, however, in Russia, the overwhelming majority of peasants own land, and the overwhelming majority of land was owned by peasants. About 98%, depending on who you read, the different agencies of the government that were in charge of this, and the census not too long before World War I broke out, the nobility was in steep decline. The peasants had taken over the land. Russia was feeding the world. Russian workers had the highest standard of living by far in Europe because the cost of living was low, but wages were still competitive with Western Europe. The currency was very stable and backed by the royal family. And so, you know, there was a great degree of confidence in the future. So, of course, the British were concerned with, well, two things. Number one, the Prussian Empire and the Russian one. And the key, of course, the secret is how can we can't fight them both. We can't fight either one, really. We have to get them fighting each other. And that's the deviousness and the evil of World War I. As far as Russia is concerned, Rasputin was the central figure there. And even scholars of the era, so-called scholars of the era, they couldn't tell you why he's evil, he just is. And the reason is because they've been conditioned to connect monarchy and orthodoxy with that figure of Rasputin. And none of it is true. It's all a caricature. One of the essential writers and scholars in this area is Oleg Platonov. He's the very first person that I read, and nothing in English exists that I know of, that really brought out this question. His concern was the domination of Masonry. Now, Russia is one country where mainstream authors are free to talk about how important Masons were. The Masonic Lodge was a way to organize to counter the royal family and the church. There were lodges within the bureaucracy itself, and their role was to work together, hopefully, and they needed a stress like a war or something like that, or a depression or something that can shake people's loyalties. Platonov argues, and he's been doing this for a long time with a tremendous amount of literature behind him, that there was an attempt to assassinate Nicholas II. After the assassinations, attempts failed. The Azef was the informer that most people know, that they tried to get, to organize the assassination attempt. It never quite worked out. But then, rather than that, they wanted to discredit the Tsar's family by creating this monster image. And this is where Rasputin comes from. A guy, but in the Duma, Guchkov really was one of the main public figures to constantly promote the idea that there was this monster running the royal family. They couldn't possibly make that stick with Nicholas. They certainly couldn't with Alexandra. They couldn't with the girls. There really was no figure that was powerful enough that could give this monstrous image. And Rasputin really was the perfect guy. He wasn't there, he was not a fixture at all. He was there very rarely for one reason and left. But they wanted this, and he couldn't be, he had to be a monster. He had to be, and they depicted him like a lot of monsters, totally outside of society. He doesn't really come from anywhere. He's just this shadowy figure that's menacing, and the less information we give the Goyim, the better. So Kerensky, Lvov, Nekrasov, Hessen, these were his supporters in the Duma as well as in the press. Platonov goes through the list of the lodge at the time, and about half the Duma members were members, even in the fourth Duma. Nikolai Mikhailovich, Alexander Mikhailovich, both Freemasons, the Deputy Minister of the Interior, the Governor General, these were the guys who were writing the fabricated police reports that were never even consistent with one another. And I bring this up partially because it's certainly a point worth talking about, that everything in that era has to be rewritten totally. But the same thing is happening now. Then you had a very healthy society whose ruling class was dying, was deep into the Masonic lodges, even though open corruption in terms of bribe taking and things like that were nowhere to be found in the bureaucracy itself. But it was healthy in general. And there are certain strictures that they had to abide by. Nicholas was very popular. The royal family was very popular. The economy was doing extremely well. And so they needed an image. The Japanese war didn't work. It worked for a short time, but it quickly died down. They needed something that would stick more. And Rasputin, who was just, it's kind of like, a guy walking down the street, you grab him and say, okay, you're going to be Rasputin. He really was very minor in the court as a whole, and he was a perfect foil for this. He had a menacing look. He was all in black. He wasn't from anywhere. He just kind of wandered places. He had magic power. He's really like a Hollywood bad guy. And this is what they needed. And none of the stories about him were consistent. He was a Jew. He was a Mason. He was a Callisti. He was an occultist. He was, all over the place. But it didn't matter. The point was to take a group of people. I mentioned the state of the American economy because people are exhausted. They're under extreme stress. This is when you hit them with psychological conditioning. The same thing with Russia. The Japanese war had ended. The revolutionary movement was killing. I think their total number prior to the revolution itself was about 40,000 people. Government officials, etc., they had assassinated, murdered throughout the Russian Empire. There was a war going on. And while the economy was doing well, the revolutionaries were constantly agitating. And in a nation that had been fairly stable, the press needed to work very hard to create a sense of foreboding and a sense of chaos. And that was in the revolutionary movement itself. Revolutionary movement was to cause enough such chaos that, in fact, the population would call for, would be easy to manipulate. So the revolutionary movement was causing the reason for its own existence, which is classic, you know, in the occult lodges anyway. In the U.S., I think the job is easier. You know, the American people believe themselves to be well-informed and shrewd. They can't be fooled. You know, they have access to such information. They think that education is something that you learn in school, you know, these kind of things. And the U.S. citizen is under extreme stress. Every single moral concept is open to question. Trump supporters were being threatened openly in the streets. The elite were shutting down rallies. You know, this would be an illegitimate election in any other country. And yet Trump still won. Creating the constant drumbeat that the American population is turning on Trump and they're rioting in the streets. All of this is one and the same thing. In this particular instance, 1917 and 2017, exactly 100 years apart, are very similar to one another. In that the creation of chaos is absolutely necessary for suggestibility. The American press is identical to the Russian. They'll make things up if they have to. I have heard now every conceivable evil that they've planted stories that Donald Trump is going to go to jail for child rape. I mean, just the most ridiculous things that have no foundation. In fact, no one's even, you know, it's outrageous. But people believe this. And of course, they're going to start talking about fake news because it's exactly what they're creating. You would expect nothing else. Situation in Tsarist Russia, late Tsarist Russia, and situation now, with all the differences in culture and society, but in terms of the press and in terms of the ruling class, the regime as such, they're identical because the enemies are the same. It's the same sort of people. It's the same ideology, now just but a different generation. There's good reason to believe now that Freemasonry is relevant only in the sense that it's been left behind and that degrees way beyond the 33rd are being achieved by all of these elitists. At the time, of course, Masonry was considered very radical, you know, in Tsarist Russia. Today, it's considered conservative. So they've gone way beyond it. The OTO went way beyond the 33rd degree. Most of the Freemasons in Petrograd were essentially partisans of the French Revolution. They were Jacobins. There's a claim in Russian history, of course, you had at least two emperors who were members, Peter I and Peter III. And, of course, throughout the middle of the 18th century, Lord Byron and his cabal were open Masons as well. And, you know, throughout the dark 18th century, the craft had been all over the nobility, the upper levels of the nobility. And this is why this increasingly irrelevant group abandoned the Tsar and Orthodoxy and joined the Jacobin movement. Part of the issue is that they were increasingly irrelevant. They were no longer a part of government in the sense that Catherine had freed them from state service. They were not going to be isolated in their estates anymore. So you had, in Dostoevsky's Possessed, really a parody of what these irrelevant people wanted to do. When you're irrelevant and you think you deserve power, you create reasons to exist. And so they found their purpose in the Jacobin clubs and in Freemasonry. And so the noble class abandoned their mortgage estates, some bought by peasants, quite a bit bought by peasants. They were simply overwhelmed with debt. And so the nobles abandoned their estates, moved into the cities, and they took up the professions. And like all revolutionary groups, they believed that they were unjustly cut out of power. And so the Jacobin idea was a way to get back at the Russian government that had excluded them. And the point of all of it is, of course, that this is classic narcissism. This is what revolution is based on. In every revolution, you have a group of powerful people who are resentful of the current royal power and want to overthrow it. And they're resentful because they believe that they are the cusp of progress. They have a lot of money, therefore they are qualified to rule, that they are increasingly being pushed out of society. that they're afraid of, in the Russian case, of becoming relics. They need another purpose. And moving from the countryside into the city alienated them even more from the population. The craft was the perfect way of joining together. I mean, it had a social element to it. They were deeply involved in the sexual revolution. I have another an essay on that floating around. And they found their unity, the upper reaches of the nobility, in attempting to overthrow Tsar Nicholas and creating a revolutionary Russia. That, of course, the very first move would be to privatize the currency. Russia was a threat to the British Empire because it was very large. Its population was going through the roof. It had discovered oil. The peasantry was very, very happy in every respect. They owned 98% of the land in the empire. They were they always had suspicions about Petrograd, but not the Tsar personally. Two very, very different things. The monarchy is not the state. The monarchy is not the bureaucracy. They saw the bureaucracy as a problem because they were the ones who they had to deal with, including at the local level. The purpose of these noble clubs was to create a pseudo-moral attempt to take power. Hopefully what it comes down to. Rasputin was resented because he symbolized the sort of the backward empire that kept them out of power. That this oaf, you know, was ruling the country somehow, but they, the refined urbanites, were being pushed out of power. This gave the anger Dostoevsky talks about in the Possessed. Well, in the American case, you have very young millionaires controlling the Disrupt 20 organization that tried to really overthrow the government during the inauguration. And it's for the same reason. You know, they believe that because of their wealth, their privilege, their power, their Ivy League background, that somehow they're the ones who should be ruling the country. And they're heavily involved in drugs, they're heavily involved in sexual revolution, in wife swapping, in a complete amoral, nihilistic activity. And that creates a warped sense of reality. You add all of that to the money and power that they have and the privilege that they have. Imagine living a life where you never hear the word no, and you're 25 years old, and you rule everything you touch, and then their archenemy is elected. Many of these investment firms, these young millionaires, are heavily dependent on illegal drugs coming from Latin America because they're users, but they're also dependent on illegal drugs because their bond markets are kept afloat by them. The money laundered through the bond market and the stock market is tremendous. It's a huge proportion of some of the liquidity, especially in lean years, comes through there. And finally, their firms use coolie labor from the third world. And it's so easy to, it's number one, you know, create this false image of corporate America, which of course they are, but they try to create this, you know, conservative image that for some reason is all in favor of limitations on immigration, although they require cheap labor. Their logic isn't their strong point. But they want to create this false image and then create the pseudo-moral idea that, you know, borders are somehow oppressive and we need a multicultural society because we're progressives and white people are ignorant. They created this whole racism idea and you can't get a job and everything else. It's totalitarianism. But these young millionaires who are financing the coup attempt that really is still going on as far as I could see in Washington, D.C., are dependent on all the things that Trump is at war with. And so far, he has already attempted to pull the rug on TPP, which again, these secret trade deals and, you know, having a court system totally away from the state, controlled by their friends, this is essential to their economic development. So they're taking this very personally because, you know, the economy is actually their bank account. And so these young guys who are very immature, they only know how to manipulate, they don't know how to actually make anything. Trump is hitting all their buttons. They're dependent on drugs. They're dependent on immorality. They're dependent on slave labor from the third world. And so they see any opponent in the same way that the regime saw Rasputin. They paint this image of this monster of this ignorant cretin, and they will say anything and do anything to have this monster that needs to be destroyed. And they'll bring about all of these fake, ridiculous moral arguments and trying to make themselves look innocent. So, you know, as we've gone on here, it's pretty clear that these two circumstances are very similar. Despite all the differences in every other respect, these movements, and I've also mentioned the 1972 situation in the U.S. When they tried to punish Nixon for being too successful and humiliating him. The same situation here. Capitalism is revolutionary. Capitalism is nihilistic. It requires constant revolution, constant agitation, or it can't function. And Trump is, at least in these areas, their primary enemy. And as Nicholas II was their primary enemy exactly 100 years ago. And therefore, they're creating this monster. And the press is pushing it. And it is the most absurd kind of superstition. And that's what we're being ruled under right now. And I've gone over my time. I appreciate my friends listening and supporting me. I ask that you continue to do so. We are in an absolutely a moment of decision. And we need to keep ourselves not only informed, but also morally pure ourselves, much as humanly possible. Thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.